with Mary Bassett, who is the fourth woman in the history of New York City to be Commissioner of Public Health. When I was invited to speak with you today, I was very excited by the idea because I've spent my career using the information that you all have generated. You are on the front lines. You know, if somebody comes to you with a problem of toxic waste or headaches in the community, you don't get to say, come back in 5 years and I'll give you an answer when I've completed my study. And that is the challenge of public health today, and I want to congratulate you for taking that challenge, although the data are often messy and the task is often quite difficult. You actually need to develop policy without definitive information often, and that's where one always has that fine blend of judgment and information. Well, as an epidemiologist, I've reached the point in life when I can tell you I truly am broken down by age and sex. But it does give us powerful information if you look at sex differences, whether in employment or family leave, to understand the ways in which our society needs to change. And what I'm going to talk with you about today is what the secret history of the war on cancer teaches us about public policy. I'm going to first tell you a little bit about the town I grew up in. How many of you have ever heard of Donora, Pennsylvania? That in and of itself is quite amazing. No, frankly, Donora, Pennsylvania was famous kind of in the way that Jack the Ripper or the Son of Sam was famous. And I never knew about it when I was growing up there, but in 1948, 20 people dropped dead in 1 5-day period from what was the first, one of the first recorded incidents of industrial pollution. And here you're on the front lines of public health, and it's not surprising that you haven't heard about Donora because it's one of those things people don't like to talk about. I'm going to then tell you a little bit about the early history of the war on cancer, and I want to stress something. In the early days of the war on cancer, people didn't make this bright line between whether we had proof of human harm. They looked at animal data and they made predictions about effects on humans in order to prevent human harm. I believe that epidemiology has become subverted, where we are constantly debating whether we can prove people are sick or not, and that really is the wrong question. The question is, do we have probable cause for believing that there is harm underway that we should intervene? How many more young, dead black men do we need before we understand that we've got a very serious problem on our hands today? The paradox of research on smoking, I think, you may not fully appreciate how much was known about tobacco, how early, versus how long it took for us to develop policies on tobacco. I don't think many are aware that we delayed in implementing the pap smear. And today, the pap smear is another example of inequities in health because we do not equally evaluate black and other minority women in terms of the pap smear. And as a consequence, their data on incidence for cervix cancer continues to be higher than that of whites in most places. Then I'm going to talk about the American College of Radiology and what it's done to advise and recommend reducing doses for children. And finally, we'll conclude with what cancer policy teaches us about current environmental health risks, including the case for reducing exposure to cell phones and the limits of epidemiology. Now, just to get you a little interested in this, I'd like to ask, how many of you have an iPhone? Just hands up. Okay, this is a little demonstration. You're going to help your colleagues here. Would you please take it out of your pocket, and I want to ask you to go to settings on your phone. You can keep it on airplane mode, which I hope it is on. All right. By the way, tech neck is a new syndrome. You can find it on the internet. People are so bent over with their 10 or 12 pound head compressing the top two cervical discs that there is a syndrome of cervical radiculitis associated with technology, right? So take a look. Try when you're using your device, by the way, to hold it up to your eye level. It's much better for you. Okay, look, go to your settings and go to general, which is about seven things down at the beginning. Give me a nod of your head or raise your hand, actually, when you got to general. Okay. Then at the top, go to about at the top. Raise your hand again when you got there. Then go all the way down to something you would not normally see called legal. And then click on RF exposure. And then you'll see the information, which I ask you to share with those around you who do not have iPhones. And it says to reduce exposure, right? Use a headset or a speakerphone and carry the device. Depending on your device, it will say 15 millimeters, 10 millimeters, or 5 millimeters. Now there, you have your warning. It's right there in the phone. I am really pleased to be working with the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, with Wyoming, believe it or not, and probably with California soon, to make awareness of this warning widely available. Because you will be surprised, many young women, and some perhaps some of you, will carry the phone in the bra. Yes, and we have some unusual cases of breast cancer associated with it. So that's the outline. Let me start by acknowledging I have some very interesting senior advisors, including, believe it or not, the former president of Microsoft for Canada and North America, as well as the Deputy Director General of the Indian Council of Medical Research. So what I'm about to show you today is on the cell phone story is something that will be surprising. But I want to go back to where I come from, Donora, Pennsylvania. This is the cover of the book When Smoke Ran Like Water. And that now is the Battersea, was formerly the Battersea Power Plant, and it has become the Tate Gallery in London. This is how the fog inspired Monet. Beautiful, right? He thought the fog was really quite amazing, and he painted more than 90 different canvases of it. This is the House of Parliament. And by the way, this is in afternoon. That's the sun reflected on the water in the smog. That was the inspiration. So fog was for years thought to be something marvelous. In Donora, where I grew up, they said smoke was prosperity. It smells like money. Sometimes people would come to the town and they'd say, "What is that smell?" And my grandfather would say, "That's the smell of money." And that was taken as a sign of prosperity, that you had to have big factories belching smoke and fumes. This is what it looked like on the hills where I played, and I thought it was wonderful because we could slide down them. We only learned later that was because of the zinc plumes. We would play kickball, which is the game of working class children, because there was no grass on the ground, because of course zinc kills that as well. This is Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at noon. Noon. Right? And the similar scene occurred later in London, and this was the London killer smog of 1952 to 57. You see, when Donora happened in 1948, it was a small town, and they said it was an act of God. They couldn't explain it. But it did give birth to public health research. It was the first time that the developing Department of Public Health, then part of security for the country, was brought in to try to study a problem. They predicted then that if a large city were hit with a similar event, thousands would die. And that is exactly what happened in London. How many of you had previously heard of the London killer smog? That's perhaps better known. But the fact is this. The warnings of Donora were ignored. And I want you to keep that in mind as we talk about the role of public health. You guys are on the front line, and I thank you for the work that you do, because your job is very difficult. You've got to prevent harm, not just predict it. So The Secret History of the War on Cancer is the other book I wrote in 2007. And the secret isn't really that surprising. We've been fighting, for much of it, the wrong war with the wrong weapons. We've been attacking the disease and not the things that cause it. And we understand that it's complex, but as Dr. Bassett just told you, I think we have to expand the purview of public health to consider all of the factors that contribute to the cancer burden, and particularly cancer inequities. This was the world's first X-ray taken in November 1895, and within 4 months it appeared on the front page of newspapers around the world. That is the ring finger of Bertha Röntgen, the wife of Wilhelm Röntgen. Their bedroom was just below the place where he experimented to develop x-rays. She never had any children, and she never again had an x-ray. When x-rays were first developed, there were x-ray parties, and people would stand in front of the machines and wiggle their bodies so they could see the skeleton move. They thought it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing. Within 5 years, the first death had occurred from radiation poisoning. Thomas Edison's assistant died of radiation poisoning, losing all of his limbs and eventually his life. So the poisonous effects of radiation were known early, and efforts were made to reduce exposures. Yet we did not take sufficient efforts with respect to diagnostic radiation until much later. We've always understood that radiation is necessary, particularly on the battlefield, particularly for emergencies. It reduces surgery, but we need to be prudent in how we use it. And that's where public health guidelines have been very important in reducing radiation to children, as you'll see in a moment. One of the things that really astonished me when I wrote The Secret History was to find out that in 1936, scientists of the world agreed that all of these things listed here were causes of cancer. In 1936, there's a wonderful book that I was able to find from an obscure library, translated into 5 languages as it was issued simultaneously. Each report was in English and Spanish and French and Russian and German and I think Japanese. And that report indicated that all of these things were then thought to be causes of cancer. What's interesting about it, you see x-rays on it, you see sunlight on it, sunlight. And I was walking on the beach yesterday with my friend in Falmouth, and I was with a 12-year-old girl who needed some more sunscreen. I stopped 9 people and asked, "Do you have any sunscreen?" They were all seated on the beach sunbathing. None of them had a single thing of sunscreen, and it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So we've got some work to do in public health for a serious problem. Coal tars and soots and benzene were known to cause cancer, as well as cobalt and uranium mining. And coal tars and soots, of course, tar is from tobacco as well. There were suggestions of the dangers of tobacco in the 19th century, earlier if you look at some of the history, and yet tobacco became a large experiment. Now, this is one other experiment that was of personal significance to me. That little baby there is my father. When it comes to benzene, my grandparents were illegally using benzene to clean clothes in the basement, and it exploded. And I learned only after her death why my grandmother had huge scars on her arms, because she had rescued my father and his brother from the fire that engulfed their building. My father died just after age 60 of multiple myeloma. We understand now that benzene is a cause of multiple myeloma. It may not be the only cause, because he had a lot of other exposures, but in fact, benzene was known to be a hazard even by the time of his birth, and yet we have not adequately controlled it. Even now, we are finding residues in cosmetics and in soft drinks. Now, sunlight, I have to share this with you because I found it so amazing. This figure from 1936 could be in a textbook today. These were drawings of animals' heads showing tumors that developed from sunlight. And also, he showed that if you painted the animal skin first with tar and then added sunlight, you got a bigger tumor faster. And he also showed that younger animals developed more tumors earlier. This is 1936. The fellow doing this was Angel Orofo. He was at the world's first Institute for Tobacco Research in 1930. So you see, there was a time before the internet. And a lot of this information was lost. And I really think it's something to consider. Why did we lose it? Why didn't we know more about it? And in my book, I speculate about some of those factors. As the industrial chemical complex began to develop after World War II, American and British Secret Service officers came in and got the data from German researchers and others, but it was not widely shared or known. That was one of the things that my book made possible. Now, it's not widely appreciated that there's been a number of paradoxes in cancer research, and one of them is the first head of the American Cancer Society until 1954, this fellow here, seen with a pipe that he's about to light on the cover of Time magazine, and no, I did not make this up. He left that job to become the founding director of the Scientific Advisory Board of the Tobacco Industry Research Council. And at that time, it was a very respected organization. Remember, there was not much money for research. There really wasn't. He was able to get hundreds of thousands of dollars to researchers at Yale and Harvard and Princeton, and they studied tobacco because they were all convinced. They were convinced it was the genes that caused cancer. That was the main belief. And the American Cancer Society was influenced heavily by that belief. When the National Cancer Act was passed, December 23, 1971, President Nixon was fighting some unpopular wars, one in Southeast Asia, the other on drugs. So he figured the war on cancer was going to be his winning ticket. And there were actually amazing debates between him and Kennedy about which one of them hated cancer more. It's very popular to hate cancer. Both of my parents died of it. I understand that. But the reality is, if we focus only on the disease and not on its causes, we are missing very important opportunities. This cartoon from Herb Bloch, I think, expresses very nicely why people have been so interested in curing cancer rather than preventing it. You see there the government berating a scientist. Could you please hurry up and find the cure? It'd be a lot easier than prevention. And right behind him, you see the asbestos industry, the food and drug industry. And as a matter of fact, for a while, the asbestos industry supported research in the U.S. government to give people a pill that would prevent asbestos workers from developing cancer. That was a very serious line of research. The tobacco industry spent more than $11 million for the American Medical Association to develop a safe cigarette. This was up into through the 1970s. So it's hard to realize how misshapen much of our cancer policy was early on. These are some ads from the Journal of the American Medical Association. And conventions and surgeons were often full of smoke well into the 1970s because smoking was very common among physicians. The safe cigarette proponents, and I'm not making this up, the director of the National Cancer Institute was a four-pack-a-day smoker into the 1970s. Ernst Winder, who was one of the first American researchers to link tobacco and cancer, was also one of the advocates of a safe cigarette. And I need not tell this group the dangers of e-cigarettes, which have been well documented by Stanton Glantz and others, and are being used as a gateway to middle school children with their bubblegum flavors. This is a serious problem that you all have to contend with, and I'd be happy to help you in any way that I can, because this idea that there are safe forms of this dangerous material, I think, really flies in the face of what we know with the data so far. Now, as an example of the safe cigarette, they came up with a filter. Some of you may remember this guy, Bob Cousy. He was a famous basketball player. A famous basketball player advertising smoking. Kent cigarette, that was the filtered cigarette. There was only one thing with it. It worked too well, and people began to complain they didn't get the taste out of it. Well, that's because it had a secret ingredient in it. Asbestos. And asbestos does filter out smoke. So we will have no way to know about the synergistic effects of using the filtered cigarette, because that data were not collected at the time. But we do know that asbestos can be very harmful. And you've been on the front lines. They're very difficult decisions often to make of leaving asbestos alone and encapsulating it as opposed to removing it safely. That was one of the reports at the National Academy of Sciences that I worked on for several years to come up with appropriate guidelines for how to handle asbestos. Probably the report at the Academy that was of the most impact was that recommended the ban on smoking first in airplanes and eventually in public places. And remember that in the 1980s, smoking was allowed in public. And you've been on the front lines to see that that is no longer the case in most places except for Nevada and a few others. Now, fresh hope on cancer is something that we've always wanted to. Hope remains the most powerful drug for someone with cancer. This is a young woman being treated for cervix cancer. They cured her, but she died because they burned a hole through her with this very high amount of radiation to which she was subjected. But I don't think most of you realize that the pap smear actually was first invented in the 1920s, shown to save lives in 1942, but not implemented until the late 1950s, and that delay cost lives. This is to show you the baseline rates of cervix cancer incidence in an early period compared to a later period, and you can see the dramatic drop, a threefold drop in most cases of cervix cancer once the pap smear was implemented. The one country that did not participate in that drop was England, because Richard Dahl wrote that this would unnecessarily raise fears in women, that it could not be clearly done outside of a doctor's office where women would be reading the pap smears. And as a consequence, this was the delay, and these are the data showing what happened in England at that same time period as compared to these other countries. Delay in implementing public health interventions can cost lives, and this is a very clear illustration of that. Now, the American College of Radiology has issued a white paper on radiation dose in medicine because the current annual collective dose for medical radiation in the United States has been huge and is getting bigger. It used to be that background radiation was higher than medical radiation. That's no longer the case. These are the radiation risks of CT scans in children. There are guidelines now from the American College of Radiology and the pediatric radiologists, but I want to bring this to your attention because you have an opportunity now to prevent cancer right now by seeing that all your public health departments are aware of this information. I wrote about it in 2007. The American College of Radiology has issued a white paper on it. The National Cancer Institute has warned about it. But it's one of the things, like skin cancer and sunlight, that we need to do a better job of giving people information about. The unadjusted pediatric CT scan of the brain for a child can give you up to 6,000 chest x-rays. In an emergency situation, you put a baby into a CT scanner that's adjusted for an adult. That's what that means. You can give them a whopping dose of radiation. Now, if a child is unconscious, they need a CT scan. That's not the debate. But we have some policies in some public health departments. For example, if you suspect child abuse, the child may get a whole body CT scan. And we really need to rethink that because of these data. We need to use radiation appropriately. And that's why they recommend federal standards be improved for training and retraining, and specifically for guidelines for ER doctors. ER docs and pediatricians are not aware. They're not aware of these issues because they're on the front line. They have to respond quickly, and the CT scan gives them the best information. But they need to understand that this is a serious amount of radiation, and we need to be wiser in how we use it. So the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends the as low as reasonably achievable dose in pediatric CT. That's a very basic public health concept. And not only are there many unnecessary CT scans in children, but people with, for example, kidney disease, gallbladder, people who are in their 30s and 40s are getting repeated diagnostic tests that are not necessary. Sometimes ultrasound can give you the same kind of information. And we need to encourage and have a major program with your departments to make sure that your hospitals are aware of these guidelines that have been issued that are not widely appreciated. Now, as to that genetic issue, I have to share with you these wonderful chromosomal bands from monozygotic twins. They start with one egg, it splits in two. So it's the closest thing we have to a clone in human nature, all right? They look close to identical here at age 3, as you can see in the bands chromosome 1, 3, and 12. This is methylation patterns that are lit up. But if you look at them by age 50, they don't even look like they're related to one another. Look at the 1 and 17, for example. And these are identical twins. This is telling us something very important, which is that genes give us the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger. That's what we know about public health in general. Genes are important, but it's environmental factors that determine methylation patterns and can even affect, we know from epigenetics, the probability that someone who's inherited a risk will develop cancer. Now, studies on children, I'm sorry I won't be able to show you the YouTube video here, but I want to show you why I'm really concerned about kids. This is a baby bouncer chair with an iPad holder above it. This is the iPoddy. And this is the iPhone teething rattle case. And of course, what do babies do if you give them a phone? Babies put things in their mouths. A cell phone is a two-way microwave radio. They call it radio frequency energy, but another term for it is microwave radiation. The radiation spectrum goes all the way from gamma and X-rays on the left here to those that we call microwave. But microwave is not really a technical term. It includes ovens and cell phones and Wi-Fi monitors and cordless phones. The difference in all of these, they use the same frequency. The difference is the power. The oven, of course, uses about 1,000 watts of power. A phone uses less than one, but the signal of a phone is pulsed. It's irregular. It goes. And the irregular nature of the signal is believed to be biologically active. This gives you another illustration of that. You have to understand about the complexity of the signal from the phone, something that it's taken me about 10 years to fully comprehend, which is that it varies in frequency, in amplitude, even in the information sent on the waves. And it's the combined effects over long periods of time that are important. So no matter how many of you have kept your phones in your pocket, now that you know that you exceed the as-tested exposure guidelines, you can put it on airplane mode and eat your vegetables and you'll be sure to get your DNA repaired because you're healthy. And the damage is not necessarily permanent. But you need to understand that this radiation has very interesting biological effects and just how much variation there is. This is a 4-second phone call. 4 seconds. And this is showing you the change in volts per meter. And this is not a log scale. The worst time to put a phone right next to your head is when you say hello, because it rings and then it peaks. And that's when you want to put it on, you just say hello, have it on a speakerphone or a headset, or use something like this, which I find I can actually hear with. I don't know about the rest of you, but I can't hear very well, and this works if you want to have a private conversation. And it also makes a point, does it not? Just to make the point, though, that change over time repeatedly is not a good thing for our cells. And studies have shown that cell phone radiation under controlled experimental conditions weakens membranes and interferes with calcium transport. And those of you with backgrounds in molecular biochemistry of carcinogenesis or just understand, calcium transport is one of the most essential things we have in the body. And this means that any toxic material in your body will be more deeply taken into your cells. And by the way, this property is being used now by the FDA to approve new medical devices because they have medical devices that use cell phone-like radiation to enhance the uptake of chemotherapy. So how can you say that this stuff has no effect? It's not the power, it's the information content on it, and the pulse nature of the signal. Cell phone standards have not changed for 18 years. Would you like to fly in an airplane with 18-year-old safety standards? When they were first set, it was for a big guy who talked for 6 minutes, and they were designed to avoid heating. The effects I'm going to show you now have nothing to do with heating. These are data that will not be in the final presentation that you'll get a copy of because this is experimental data I'm going to be presenting later this week at a seminar of the Bioelectromagnetic Society, and it's not published. This is the scale. I want you to look that the white-yellow is the hottest. Okay, that's how this works. This is the brain of a six-year-old. This has not been done before. That's kind of amazing, to have anatomically based models. The other models that I can show you in the material that are available, those models only scaled up. This is an anatomically based model that takes into account the differential density of the hippocampus and the temporal parietal lobe, etc. Take a look at the white area, under the phone, that goes into the eye and down a little bit into the brainstem. This is the 11-year-old. It's a smaller white area, not so much into the eye in the yellow and white. And this is a 34-year-old. The point is, cell phone radiation does get into the brain. And while it is weak, the pulse nature of the signal over many thousands of minutes and years has a biological effect. Now, the effect is not limited to the head. It has also a systemic effect. And we are very concerned at Environmental Health Trust about this issue, and that's why we're really pleased to be working with a number of state health departments. And we'd love to work with CTSE as an organization to make people more aware of this, and we'll give PDFs of all the material that we have available. I'm going to show you some of it next so that you can copy them, vet them for your health departments, and make whatever changes you would like. This is the modeling published by industry of exposure to a 7- and 9-month-old fetus, and you see that by 9 months, as every woman in this room knows who's had a baby, that fetus is right there at the surface where, of course, the cell phone radiation gets in. That's why we're working with Yale University. Professor Hugh Taylor is the senior officer here. Professor Taylor and I have started something called the Baby Safe Project. We have more than 100 obstetricians and gynecologists who have signed on. At Yale University, a pregnant woman goes into that center and she gets a pamphlet telling her to keep the cell phone away from the pregnant abdomen. This is the study that they did and published in a Nature publication called Scientific Reports, and they found prenatally exposed mice to cell phone radiation developed significant alterations in behavior using standard animal assays to measure that behavior, looking at memory, hyperactivity, anxiety, and fear. Look at the bar graphs, show it a little bit more clearly. Look at the hyperactivity. Twice as much hyperactivity, just about, in the prenatally exposed mice. Statistically significant deficits in memory and anxiety, but no difference in fear. So this is very worrisome because it's consistent with other research showing neurological effects, effects on the hippocampus, effects on the cerebellum. These are pretty important parts of the brain. This is a study showing Wi-Fi damages sperm. Again, at the bar graph, you will see that the Wi-Fi exposed sperm have more DNA damage. These are controlled studies controlling for heat. Now, the response to many countries has been to take action spurred by their public health departments. In Belgium, the public health minister called for and received a ban on cell phone sales for children under 7. And you cannot ban advertisements on television. You know, all of those trash-talking babies we have, like they have to grow up faster with their cell phones, that's banned in Belgium. Australia has also given advice to parents to limit children's exposure to cell phones. In Toronto, in the United States, my new hometown of Jackson, Wyoming, has issued cell phone safety awareness. But Berkeley unanimously passed the cell phone right to know ordinance. Anybody here from Berkeley? Well, thank you for that. And it came from the actions of public health officials working with advocates at the local level. And by the way, a standing offer from Professor Lawrence Lessig of Harvard Law School and Dean Robert Post of Yale University Law School: any city or any state that passes the cell phone right to know ordinance, which simply says you have a right to know the information that's buried in your phone, Yale and Harvard will defend that pro bono all the way to the Supreme Court because it's the same issue as tobacco and many other things, which is, as some of you may know, the tobacco industry has successfully used their First Amendment argument to stop putting graphic labels on cigarettes because they say it's a form of compelled speech and violates their First Amendment rights because you're forcing them to tell you something that they don't want to tell you. The cell phone industry's response to the Berkeley ordinance is to sue, saying, you cannot compel us to tell you what's buried in the phone. I find it bizarre, but that's why we have Professors Lessig and Post who have agreed publicly to defend any locality or state that will adopt this ordinance. Massachusetts, I'm pleased to say, is very interested in this. I briefed legislators at the Boston State House this week, and I'm currently working with Suzanne Condon and her staff to develop innovative messages to public on information found within devices. And I believe Fran is here somewhere, and she is working on this, and I actually just got an email from Suzanne that I want to talk to you about after our meeting. So this is the Baby Safe Project, and all of this information is available, and this one has been focus group tested about ways to reduce your exposure for pregnant women, and we have attractive materials. I guess people think that women like pink, and I guess I know little girls do, but I suppose I kind of find this a little strange, but we have to go with what people will like, and we have to give people information that they can handle and use in a practical way. And we are not anti-technology. We are simply pro-health. This is a very important difference. We have started another website called showthefineprint.org, and that website takes all the information in all of your devices. For example, this is what it says in the top paragraph for the Galaxy S5. Body-worn SAR testing has been carried out at a separation distance of 1 centimeter. To meet exposure guidelines, the device should be positioned at least this distance away from the body. And they're honest, at least. My advice is a few inches. That's all. That's all you have to do. We need to tell our children this. People have to understand that the iPad is called a tablet because it's tested on a table. There is no way it's safe for little kids to sit around a circle holding it with their hands when the standard testing distance is 20 centimeters and their hands aren't even 20 centimeters long. There's a huge disconnect between what's happening with the schools where the proliferation of Wi-Fi into elementary schools, something that the Israeli government doesn't recommend, and they know a little bit about this technology, something the Indian government does not recommend, and they're also high-tech, and something the Korean government does not recommend. Those three high-tech countries, Korea, Israel, and India, with whom I'm now working, all advise safety for children's exposure. This is other information from the Baby Safe Project about the risks that wireless radiation poses to the baby's brain development, and a statement from Professor Taylor at Yale, who is the chief of obstetrics and gynecology, saying, as a research scientist and physician who studies how microwave radiation affects the outcomes of pregnancy, I am deeply concerned about growing exposures to cell phone and other wireless radiation. So this is one of our campaigns, Save the Girls. The manufacturers say don't keep the phone next to the body. Unfortunately, we now have 38 cases of unusual breast cancer. Several of them are primary multifocal, where the tumors have developed right under the antenna of the phone. Two of them are age 21. None of them is positive for the mutations, BRCA, et cetera. This is the advice that comes on that brochure. It's two-sided, so the cover is this, the back is that, telling you to protect your body, how to do it, how to practice safe tech. This is the other one, Save the Boys. This is actually a very serious issue. The Cleveland Clinic has shown men who carry phones in their pocket the longest have a reduced sperm count with the most mitochondrial DNA on their sperm. I don't have the time to show you those slides. All of this and more information can be found on our website. This is the back of that slide. Research does show damage to sperm, and by the way, erectile dysfunction. That's not something that most people like to hear about, but it's a serious problem. It really is, and there are multiple causes for infertility in this country today, but this is certainly one you can do something about. And that's why I want to conclude my presentation with these things you can do something about. Because you see, a lot of the problems Dr. Bassett talked about, the profound problems of inequity and lack of justice for poor people, particularly blacks in the urban environment, those problems are going to take years to solve. And if anyone wants to see a documentation of the nature of police brutality, by the way, Harper's Magazine just had a summary where they extracted from the police settlements in Baltimore just the description of the things that happened for which people got $150,000. And it makes stunning reading. A pregnant woman tries to intervene on behalf of two schoolgirls that are fighting, and she ends up getting thrown to the ground, handcuffed, taken away from her four-year-old child. She received $150,000. It's right there. It's a documentation of what we know. Those problems are going to take considerable time and effort. These problems can be easily addressed with major public education. I don't say so easily because, of course, like tobacco, we waited way too long, and now we have the problem that there's so many little kids running around. I interviewed a woman who told me, someone said to her, how did you ever change a diaper before cell phones? She said, what? She said, well, I always give my baby my phone so that she can be distracted while I'm changing her diaper. You're supposed to talk to the baby. That's how they learn. And there already are stories on speech delay in mothers and fathers who are using their phones more and not looking at their babies. They think they're with the baby, but they're just like this. It's having serious impacts, and we can do something about it. This is one way the New Yorker described it. And I think it's, you know, rather extreme. But all of us, me too, easily get addicted to these things. They're very powerful, they're very convenient, and I'm not opposing it. I just think we need to be a little bit more realistic and understand that we can control our lives rather than have our lives be controlled by the technology. So there have been, I think, in the cartoon world, there have been a number of expressions of this. And all of us have been at meetings where people are sitting down there and looking at their device and sort of, and when you do that, you think you're listening, right? But the evidence suggests that we're not really paying full attention. How many times have you had to repeat something to a colleague because they were not fully there? It's a problem for everyone. So if you want the future to be different from the past, you have to study the past. I hope that what I've told you today will make you think a little bit differently about these current problems. We need to document problems in public health in order to change them. That's why it's so important to have the work documenting injustices, inequities. We need to use data to tell a story to create targets and goals. That's what we do in epidemiology. But here's a problem you can do something about. That's why I wanted to conclude with this information. That's why I was delighted to have the invitation to speak with you today. Let's get this information into the hands of young parents and teachers and students. We have, if you go to our website, you'll see we have the annual Art and Science Technology Contest to Practice Safe Technology. Our award winner this year has a wonderful song on practice safe tech that she wrote herself. You can find it on our website. I conclude with this statue from Dachau, which I don't think many of you have seen. It's life size. It's kind of small. It sits off in the corner. And on the bottom is a slogan in German that says, we honor the dead to warn the living. So as I look back in a fairly long career in public health at our efforts on tobacco and smoking and vinyl chloride and asbestos, there is no question in my mind, and I hope not in yours, that we waited far too long to act against smoking or asbestos, and the evidence that we had to have to justify public policy were dead bodies and significant numbers of injured people. And I think The real challenge you face today is how to formulate public policy when you don't have dead bodies and you don't want to wait for them anymore. So I'd like to leave you with some websites and information that we have. And I confess I'm not up on all this social media, but I've been told that you need to do it. So we have all of this stuff out there. And I would invite you to please join us if you would like to be part of this effort. I'm going to share this information with CTSE. Some of our materials are here. I believe we will have more for you tomorrow, some of the Save the Girls and Save the Boys and whatnot. And please like us and send us information. And I'm not the us you're sending it to, so don't expect me actually to reply. But if you are interested, I would appreciate sending emails to info@ehtrust.org. And I look forward to working with this organization. And again, I really thank you for the important work you're doing.